This is Tribes of Dakota, an ongoing project of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Charlie Aberesk. In the next hour, we'll hear the perspectives of Indigenous people from across the state. In Indian country, the past lives with the present. Many Native people in South Dakota remain connected to their history. Traditional elders often remember the teachings of their grandparents, an oral history handed down by the keepers of culture and language. We begin our journey today speaking with elders from the Cheyenne River Reservation. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Francis Lynn has this story about their effort to overcome the impact of federal assimilation policies.
A screen door closes quietly at a senior citizens living center in Eagle Butte. It is the home of Dora Brewer, or Grandma Dora, as she is affectionately called. She is a petite woman with a quiet strength that defies her 88 years. Her small but cozy apartment is filled with pictures of her grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and a tabby cat named Keely. With a face that is lined with wisdom, her piercing brown eyes stare off into the distance. She reflects on a childhood riding horses with her brothers and learning what she calls Lakota ways.
My folks, my father and mother are Indian medicine people. To heal people. So we live way out to the country where there's a log house that we live in. And along the creek, there's a sweat lodge.
Brewer remembers her early years as being isolated from other community members. Her parents were worried the children would be taken to boarding school, so they kept them close to home.
Nobody hardly see us. The reason why later I found out that they didn't want us to send away to school because me and my brothers were out there until we were older. Then some people came and said, you have to go to school.
The memory of the day the missionaries came to take her to boarding school is etched clearly in Brewer's mind. That morning, a black car drove down the hilltop towards her parents' farm. Inside were two missionaries and an Indian interpreter. Her mother warned her that the Wasichus, or white men, were coming.
She said, stay behind and look. She said, they might kill us and take you. And I started to cry when my brother hung on to me. Shh, don't cry. They won't, he was saying, but the way she said it, she scared me.
As part of an official governmental policy which sought to kill the Indian and save the man, Lakotas were forced to assimilate to American values. As spiritual leaders, the Brewers kept a traditional teepee and sweat lodge where they could perform healing ceremonies. When the missionaries came to take the children to school that day, they burned down what her family considered sacred.
And they were doing something, and all of a sudden it went into a flame. That teepee burned, and then the sweat lodge burned. My father had a little drum, so he stood back and sang a song. I don't know if he was singing. He always sang it. So he sang a song, and they came and grabbed me and took that drum and threw it in there, too.
Until the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934, Lakota children were forcibly removed from their parents and sent to boarding schools. While they were given a Western education, they were also often beat for speaking their native language or for practicing traditional spirituality.
At first, it was hard for us, because when we talk, they slap our mouths and shake us up and punish us. So we don't hardly talk, so they think we're dumb or something, but, you know, it's really hard at first. But we soon learn, and we got along okay.
While Brewer eventually adapted, she left school in eighth grade after officials would not allow her to return home for her father's funeral. Brewer's family was not alone in experiencing religious persecution. Events like these drove Lakota spirituality underground for many years. It's lunchtime at the Cheyenne River Elderly Nutrition Center in Eagle Butte. Seniors chat while hot food is served on plastic trays. Director Ione Garrow greets diners with her warm smile and infectious laughter. Sitting in the spacious dining area, Garrow shares more pleasant memories of the boarding school life.
Because the nuns, the priests, whatever, they provided for us. So we had three squares. We had breakfast. We went to school. We did everything that you're supposed to do in the morning. We had chores to do. Then we'd have our dinner. Our lunch would come. And then at 3 o'clock, I remember we got a slice of bread. Oh, that bread was so good. And I love yet a nice big thick slice of bread because that's what we used to get.
While Garo has fond memories, she doesn't speak Lakota and says life at the boarding schools led to a generation not learning the language.
And there's a lot of Indian women that wouldn't teach their children because they went through so much at the government schools. They slapped their hands. They punished them for talking their own language. And they said, no way are you going to ever have to be in that. You learn the English language, and that's what you're going to do.
Today, many young people are trying to learn Lakota for use in ceremonies, but there are few children who know it as their first language. At a small powwow in the new Eagle Butte Teen Center, the fluorescent gymnasium lights contrast sharply with the dancers' colorful costumes of beads and feathers. Richard Charging Eagle, dressed in blue jeans and a black veteran's baseball cap, is acting as MC.
7192. 7192.
He believes if his people lose the Lakota language, they will also lose key pieces of their spiritual beliefs as well.
When you lose your language, you have no culture, you have no tradition, you have no spirituality, because you can't separate the spirituality in the Indian or Lakota ways. You lose the language, it doesn't mean anything.
Charging Eagle became a powwow MC after he returned home from the Vietnam War. He believes his work with the community is part of his continuing commitment to serve his people. However, Charging Eagle worries Lakota culture is being lost. He says this is evident even in today's powwows.
Traditional powwow is something that you go just to socialize, enjoy yourself, have a good time, make new friends, or even relatives. This is the place, the traditional thing. This is where the honoring should really come. This is where what it is. And then somewhere in late 60s, a contest came into the picture. And people, the only way people will dance now is if there's a contest or money involved in it. So they kind of ruined her. They're lost.
Charging Eagle adds greed does not represent traditional values. He believes imitating competitive American society is a result of an educational system which ridicules Lakota culture.
And there's a generation of people that are ashamed to be Indian, so they rather not speak the language or rather not learn the ways. And it's really sad. You can tell who doesn't want to be an Indian. They're ashamed to be an Indian because the education system will make fun of you because you're an Indian. So the older people are proud to speak a broken English because they said, I have not been conquered by a white man.
Charging Eagle is alarmed by what he sees as a vanishing language, culture, and spirituality. He has this warning for the Lakota people.
Friends and relatives, try to learn your ways because there's hard times coming if you don't learn your ways.
For thousands of years, elders have been the keepers of culture. It is through them that their children and grandchildren come to make sense of the world around them. Never before have elders had to teach so much. This generation may be the last to speak Lakota as their first language and may be the last to remember some of the sacred songs and stories. However, in their traditional ways, they continue to pass on the values and beliefs that make them a distinct culture. Values and beliefs that make them uniquely Lakota.
Despite the work of elders to pass on the positive teachings of Lakota culture, negative stereotypes within mainstream society also exist. Like other minorities, Native peoples of South Dakota often face damaging racial prejudice. We will now hear from Jace DeCorey, professor of Indian Studies at Black Hills State University, who talks about the stereotype that people in Indian country are lazy.
As far as hardworking people, I think the Lakota, the Native people, are some of the hardest working people in the nation. You know, there are different values about what is productive and what is not productive. we're taught that we're not supposed to be lazy anyway. When we're little, they said that, you know, that's kind of not a cool thing to be called. So you want to be industrious, and you want to do the best of your own ability. You know, what the talents that the Creator gave you, use those in a good way.
DeCorey and other scholars note that there is no direct translation to the Lakota word for boredom. She says that's because traditionally Lakota people were always busy working. The concept of being bored never entered their minds. Next, Rosalie Littlethunder, professor of Lakota language at Black Hills State, will share a Lakota word that reflects the values of perseverance, endurance, and discipline.
Wachintanka.
Wachintanka.
Wachintanka. It's a pretty significant word in Lakota behavior. You know, there are a lot of different weaknesses that we have as human beings. And likewise, there are many disciplines, ways to discipline ourselves so that we don't succumb to the weaknesses. So Wachintanka, you know, has multiple meanings, but for me, it's just the word that captures all those things that we must do in order to be good human beings.
It's the elders who preserve the traditional values like Wachintanka. In Indian country, elders are highly respected and cared for. And if you get the chance to speak with a traditional Lakota elder for very long, the conversation may well come around to treaty rights. The issue of land rights and treaties is paramount to many Native people in South Dakota. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt now takes us to the Yankton Sioux Tribe in an attempt to look at the treaties from the perspective of tribal people.
Beneath the top of Fort Randall Dam in Charles Mix County, Generator 1 joins nearly a dozen other machines in a low, steady hum. That quiet belies its responsibility to provide power to southeast South Dakota and parts of six other states. On the other side of the thick concrete dam, water rushes through huge pipes to run the generators and provide the electricity. The Fort Randall Dam creates the southern boundary of Lake Francis Case, which stretches northwestward to Chamberlain. But the boundaries of the neighboring Yankton Sioux Reservation are a little more difficult to define. Just over 200 years ago, the tribe laid claim to over 13 million acres, stretching from the Des Moines River to the Missouri River. Now, to some people outside tribal lands, there's no reservation there at all, and no reason for sovereignty.
What?
But Sam Weddle, the tribe's economic development coordinator, sees it differently. In the tribal council chambers, located at the Yankton Sioux headquarters in the small town of Marty, Weddle points to a map on the paneled wall that comprises the southern half of Charles Mix County.
Yeah, there it is right there on the wall. And the Supreme Court has ruled for us.
The tribe has been in and out of court against the state and federal governments for much of its existence over such issues as removal of burial sites, jurisdiction of police, and whether the reservation is a reservation at all. Hoover says the state government tried to disestablish the Yankton Sioux Reservation boundaries in 1996.
I was there as the expert witness for history. The state argued that tribal government had not been continuous. They were going to get at it that way. But with a little luck, I was able to prove that it had never been interrupted. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and Sandra Day O'Connor wrote in favor of the tribe as recommended by Judge Lawrence Pearsall here in the district.
2 years later, the state and tribe were back in court, but this time the tribe lost. In 1998, the boundaries of the Yankton Sioux Reservation were officially disestablished. Like any tribe existing under government treaties, the Yankton Sioux work to preserve their autonomy and want their treaties and individual rights preserved. Charmaine Whiteface of Rapid City studies those rights for the group Defenders of the Black Hills. She's also the spokesperson for the Sioux Nation Treaty Council.
The treaty was made purposely for us to continue to survive as a nation. That was the original intent. Otherwise, without our treaty and without our land area and those relationships, then we just become brown Americans, part of the American system, and we're no longer Ocheti Shakoi.
Despite court challenges and alleged ongoing mistreatment, the Yankton Sioux are a peace-loving people, as shown by their flag. It's a brilliant scarlet, a traditional native color of hospitality. The outline of a peace pipe appears in yellow, and there's an inscription that the tribe is land of the friendly people of the Seven Council Fires. Again, Sam Weddle.
You know, the tribes is one. When you say the tribes, like here nowadays, they say the tribes. They say Flandreau Tribe, Siston Tribe, Pine Ridge Tribe, Rosebud Tribe. But actually, we're all one tribe, and that we've just got seven bands.
Charmaine Whiteface, Treaty Council spokesperson, says through the years, all Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota have aimed for peace. She says they signed treaties with the U.S. government in good faith.
The United States asked for peace treaties with us, and that's what we signed, and the last one was the 1868 peace treaty. And we accepted the loss of 13 and a half states in order to have this peace. And yet, the United States was the one that came in with their soldiers in 1874, and the President of the United States at that time, Ulysses S. Grant, told the soldiers, don't keep the miners or the pioneers out of this area in violation of the treaty.
That 1868 treaty, known as the Fort Laramie Treaty, left the Black Hills and all of western South Dakota under Lakota control. Whiteface says the Black Hills have special significance to all seven bands.
They are affected by the Black Hills because all of us consider the Black Hills sacred, whether they are Nakotas living in Canada or the Yanktons, you know, in the southeast South Dakota. We all consider the Black Hills sacred, so all of us were very much concerned when the Supreme Court tried to give us money for the Black Hills. You can't sell something that's sacred.
In 1980, the U.S. Supreme Court awarded the Great Sioux Nation $106 million for loss of the Black Hills. Whiteface says that decision recognized the validity of the 1868 treaty, and the Supreme Court acknowledged government wrongdoing in breaking the treaty.
In the 1980 Supreme Court decision said, a more ripe and rank case of dishonorable dealings will in all probability never be found in our history, meaning the history of the United States. And it brought hope. It brought hope that the United States still had some integrity. And it brought hope that maybe justice would finally prevail. What happened next was the Supreme Court said, okay, we're not going to give you the land back, we're going to give you money.
The tribes in South Dakota are among the poorest people in the U.S., but they still refuse to accept the court-ordered payment from the federal government. Today, with interest, the award would be worth nearly $600 million.
And we could not accept money because the Black Hills are sacred. That's like trying to sell your child or your wife or your mother. You can't sell things that are sacred.
But for many like Whiteface, treaty rights are about even more than land claims. She says treaty rights are tied to human rights. She says this is the same hope for people around the world.
Right now, the United Nations is looking at a declaration on the human rights of indigenous people. Human rights are the right to be who the Creator made us to be. That is a human right.
Whiteface says the Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota people will continue to exercise their rights as a nation. She says, besides passing on the language and culture to the youth, the tribes will also pass on the struggle for treaty rights and for return of sacred lands that were taken from them.
The history of South Dakota is often marked by racial tension and conflict, but despite the stereotypes, reaction to that history has been much more restrained, says Jace DeCorey. She says the media has too often perpetuated negative ideas of Native people.
Well, one of the stereotypes is all Natives, or all, especially Lakota people, I guess, are violent. It's getting better, but at one time, they would not put anything positive in the newspapers. So all you would read would be the police blotter kind of type information if something negative happened or something bad happened, and it was, you know, related to Native American people, American Indian people. And I think that kind of perpetuates that idea of being Native people being violent.
DeCorey notes that Lakota culture is based heavily in the values of cooperation and communal living. These values are reflected directly in the language. Rosalie Littlethunder has another Lakota word to share. This one highlights a difference between Lakota and Christian teachings.
Wa'as iye shinia. Is kind of a command or guidance, you know, that we get from parents. And basically, you know, it means to not cause anybody to wish for something or to want something. And it's in direct contrast to another rule, which is thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's goods. You know, it's direct opposite of that. In that rule, you know, you're the bad person if you covet something, you know, that belongs to somebody else. But in Lakota way, it's not good to be the one causing other people to covet what you have. So you don't show off things, or you don't eat in front of other hungry people. It pretty much says you either put it away or you share it.
Lakota grandmothers may be the first to teach language to the youngsters. In the traditional Lakota worldview, women have more power. Rosalie Little Thunder says Lakota society is more matriarchal than mainstream culture. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Julia Munzunski takes us to Rosebud, South Dakota, to speak with the woman who founded the first domestic violence shelter on an American reservation.
On this bright summer afternoon, Verna Matoishtima opens the door to a large two-story house in downtown Mission on the Rosebud Reservation.
We have a tight security system here, so therefore, when we press this doorbell, we have to ID ourselves in order to come in.
This is the first women's shelter in Indian country. It was founded by Tilly Black Bear in 1977. Matoishtima is the lead advocate at the shelter. Two children staying here race down the hallway. Nearly 30 years ago, Tilly Black Bear started the White Buffalo Calf Women's Society. The organization provides shelter and direct services for women. Matoishtima was one of the first to stay here as a victim of domestic violence. She has known Black Bear since the beginning.
Tilly is a strong, courageous, inspiring woman, very spontaneous. And she's known in a national level, she's known in the state level, and also locally. And she's the boss, she's a friend, she's a mother. She's just a very inspiring woman to all of us.
Through the years, Black Bear has received many awards for her work on behalf of women, including the prestigious Eleanor Roosevelt Human Rights Award. Working at the administrative headquarters of the White Buffalo Calf Women's Society, Black Bear reflects on the significance of the organization's name.
Of course, you know, we carry a very sacred name, White Buffalo Calf Women's Society. You know, it's about the legend of how the sacred Chinupa, the pipe, was brought to the people. It was by a woman. And so we have that real strong connection to that sacredness, and we do have a responsibility to fulfill, you know, to hold ourselves accountable for the work that we do.
Many Lakota people believe that one of the first teachings of White Buffalo Calf Woman was respect for women and children, even in thought. Traditional spirituality infuses much of the work here. Black Bear says spiritual leaders help guide the work they do.
We work very closely with some medicine people who provide us with guidance, provide us with the kind of ceremonies that we need to do the work. And the grandmas, especially the grandmas, always tell us that we have to go through these ceremonies, and we do practice those ways.
Black Bear believes tapping into those traditional ways is a key to making real change happen in people's lives.
And I think more and more of our young people are returning to these old ways. And I think from that perspective, then, I think it gives them a more balanced outlook on life. But it's, for many of them, it's reclaiming those old ways. And I think that's, for me, that's a real strong basis for the kind of work that people do here, because it's bringing back something that was a real integral part of our total being.
The society aims to incorporate traditional practices in rebuilding the lives of those they serve.
You know, we work towards reintroducing ceremonies for women and helping women, you know, if they want to go on a vision quest, we have helped them with whatever they need to have done.
Sweats are a healing practice women can participate in if they choose. A sweat lodge is right on the shelter's property. Verna Matoishima opens the gate to a fenced area.
When women feel the need to have a sweat, then Tilly coordinates that.
Matoishima stands in a grassy yard near the frame for the sweat lodge. She says doing a sweat can help women who stay here.
A lot of times women come to the shelter with a lot of mixed emotions and hurt feelings and broken spirits. And so therefore, a sweat lodge is good. It's good for them to sweat so that they can pray and heal themselves.
At the administrative office, a little yellow house next door to the shelter, Tilly Blackbear says there is a strong tradition of women being powerful in the Lakota culture. But she says that power was undermined when white people took over their territory.
Traditionally, tribal women owned property. We kept our own names. When we married, we didn't become Mrs. So-and-so. You know, with the impact of Western civilization, with the impact of Europe, colonization, where when the white folks came over from Europe, they owned their women. The children were, they owned the children, which is a totally, you talk about a complete paradigm shift. When we interfaced with the U.S. government, you know, the only way they dealt with the tribes was through the men. You know, and so again, that really, I think, impinged upon the sovereignty of women. And when we look at sovereignty of women, you know, it's a whole new dynamic that's resurfacing, although it's always been there, you know, because women were very sovereign.
Upholding the sovereignty of women has been the society's mission from the start. Black Bear says that it's about the daily work making sure women and their families have a safe place to stay as long as they need. And it's about providing programs and counseling to help women heal from violent relationships. But above all, she says, it's about drawing on traditional Lakota culture and changing society itself.
And we're also about working outside the box, thinking outside the box. Okay, this is a status quo, but let's look beyond that and see how can we make changes and yet utilize our own cultural resources.
Black Bear says it's good to see so many young people on the Rosebud reconnecting with the old ways. This resurgence of traditional values, she says, will ensure sovereignty of Lakota women far into the future.
The use of traditional Lakota culture is helping to restore the lives of victims of domestic violence. It is also being used to help those who perpetuate violence against women. Rosalie Little Thunder helps teach a summer retreat for men who are convicted of battering their wives. One of the words she teaches to the men's recovery camp deals with being responsible for one's own actions.
Aich iblesa. Aich iblesa. Aich iblesa. Aich iblesa is to know yourself, to really sort things out, and it kind of helps people to get away from blaming other things, other people, for their own behavior, and it's take a hard look at yourself. What do you have to do with your problems, you know, your dilemma, your behavior? Is take a hard look at yourself and own that behavior.
While the Lakota culture places high value on responsibility, there is a negative stereotype that Native people are irresponsible when it comes to time. Jace DeCorey helps explain the concept of Indian time.
I think Indian time's great. But I think how it came about is that because we are so into flex time, we do things that need to get done, and if it takes longer, we get it done. Now, sometimes we get late because of that. But Native people have always been very cognizant, I think, of all of the times of the seasons. The seasons are really strong for us. We know that when we have to do certain things during certain times, those kinds of things. So that is Indian time as well. And that's a positive Indian time, I think. I think that we can't lose those kinds of things.
Conflict between traditional cultural roles and modern pressures are everywhere in present-day Indian life. Nowhere is that conflict more apparent than with tribal gaming. New economic realities have led to concerns in Indian country about balancing preservation of traditional values and culture with the need for economic growth. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Chuck Beck now takes us to Flandreau.
It could be argued that recess is one of the best things about first grade. On a chilly September morning, groups of Flandreau kids are playing outside the local elementary school. These first grade students may not realize it, but the reading assignments they will be doing later today are thanks to this. It's good time, big time fun at the River Casino. Just a couple of miles from the school sits a three-level building the size of two football fields. The Royal River Casino houses a restaurant, a hotel, conference rooms, a gambling hall, and a concert venue. Flandreau Public Schools Superintendent Rick Weber says this casino is helping keep the school system afloat.
Well, we had this federal grant that ran out 2 years ago. Well, just like any federal grant and that sort of thing, when it runs out, it runs out. We look to ways to fund it, and with the funding system we have in our South Dakota public schools right now, we will not be able to come up with the almost $200,000 to keep it going.
Unlike some of the other tribal casinos in South Dakota, the Royal River Casino is close to a major population center, Sioux Falls. The casino has proved to be highly successful for the tribe, bringing in thousands of dollars each year for tribal government. Sam Allen, the Economic Development Coordinator for the Flandreau Santee Sioux Tribe, says most of the community is supportive of the casino.
We employ about 540 people, and the majority of the population here, one way or another, is employed, whether they're supporting a family or a relative.
Scott Kellogg is staring at a TV in the corner of Fat Boy's Bar in downtown Flandreau, while two men to his left are prodding him to answer Jeopardy questions. Kellogg has sort of a weathered and ruddy complexion with long hair. He's a Flandreau native, but he is one in this community who has mixed feelings about the casino.
Some of the bad points are they bring in some different people from different places that you probably don't want in your town. So it's a catch-22. What do you do?
A few minutes ago, Dick Grafing was sparring with Kellogg over Jeopardy. But he now agrees on the impact of the casino. Grafing says the money generated isn't trickling down to those who need it.
It's just undercutting the rest of the community. Most of these people come in there, they go down there, they gamble, they never come downtown. So it didn't do us any good at all.
Medical records.
Receptionist Betty Jacobs answers the phone in the medical records department at Keystone Treatment Center in Canton. The rehabilitation center helps treat gambling addicts, and gambling counselor Sue Van Doren says the casino can create addiction in Indian country.
I think the accessibility makes a lot of difference. I mean, the closer that one is to a casino, there's a higher increase for addiction.
But tribal officials say casinos prove to be one of the few solid investments on reservations and the only vehicle that many tribes use to raise money. Allen says the tribes have the sovereign right to build and operate casinos free from state regulations.
We can do things. We can own businesses. We can start businesses. But we have to have the tools to do it. We don't receive any aid from the state whatsoever. But if we have what the market can bear, like anybody else, we could do so much more in terms of development.
But George Eagleman, a counselor at Keystone Treatment Center in Canton, says the tribes aren't getting a real taste of sovereignty.
The only reason the tribes have casinos on the reservation is because the state has it. And any gambling that is offered through the state, the tribes are entitled to do the same thing. So they have a compact with the state to build those casinos. You know, so they believe that gambling is going to really bring the, any type of bring economy into the reservations and economic infrastructure, et cetera, or some business ventures, and it just doesn't happen.
Many, like Eagleman, add that traditional cultural values can be in conflict with casinos. Those who are against gaming say some tribes in South Dakota haven't developed casinos because local elders oppose this form of business. But Economic Development Coordinator Sam Allen has a different take. In fact, he says the casino is eyeing plans to expand, but he says adding on more gaming machines and a bigger concert hall would require state approval.
The community will be better off for the expansion, just for the fact that there'll be more jobs, there'll be more money that's contributed to the community fund for education, roads, infrastructure. So the tribe is better off with gaming. And if we're able to continue, I can see a lot of changes.
But Eagleman says rather than pushing for expansion, the tribe should take a deeper look at the problems that could arise from gambling.
If gambling wasn't there and was being introduced and was about to happen, then I would take consensus. Or if it's happening now, I would take consensus to see how many are really addicted, you know, to pathological gambling. And if a population of 15,000 is, you got 2,000 that are addicted, you know, then probably I will look at the business aspect of what the casino can produce for the tribe and the money they make, then we'll probably establish more treatment facilities, you know, that can help them, educate them.
Sherwin and Pam Linton are a regular country music act at Royal River Casino. They sing in a small gambling hall that tribal officials hope to expand into a large concert venue. While casino managers are putting their efforts towards expansion, some Native people in South Dakota are concerned about the impacts of gambling and the role big business should play in their culture. In the end, the approval for expansion will come not from tribal residents, but from the state of South Dakota.
While there may be a concern that casinos could cause an increase in gambling addiction in Indian Country, Professor Jace DeCorey will join us now to discuss the negative stereotype about alcohol addictions among Native Americans.
You know, we did establish a different, I don't know if it's a different drinking pattern or a different kind of way of looking at alcohol, because it was new to us. When Native people were first introduced to alcohol, it was such a, it was amazing because it altered your behavior. Grandpa Fool's Crow used to always say that it was like a medicine, or it was waka, it was sacred, mysterious, because it changed how you behaved. You know, I think that there are just as many non-Native drunks, I think, as there are Native drunks, but it's scary because it is waka and it does alter your behavior.
Recent studies have shown that the rate of alcoholism on Indian reservations is only about 10% off of the national average. However, abusing alcohol is not a traditional Lakota value. Rosalie Little Thunder shares a Lakota word that deals with the value of honor.
Igluoniha. 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 Igluoniha, it means to conduct yourself with honor. When you misbehave, then you're dishonoring yourself. Or if you're not treating other people with respect in an honorable way, then it means to dishonor yourself. So it's a pretty important word, you know, is to conduct yourself with honor. Doesn't mean you dress up fancy and brag about yourself, you know, but it does mean, you know, to treat people well and compassionately, and that's the only way you can honor yourself, is, you know, to be a good human being and to be a good relative to other human beings.
Lakota values like Igluoniha are kept alive on the state's reservations, but the poor conditions and unemployment rates up to 80% are pushing large numbers of Native Americans off reservations and toward urban areas. Census numbers show nationwide a majority of tribal members now live off reservations. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Johanna Saylor has this report on what Native Americans find when they leave tribal lands.
Wayne Starboy is hunched over a cluttered workbench. He tips up his cowboy hat to shed more light on his work. In his hand, Starboy holds a tool that looks like an electronic screwdriver, but with a high-speed bit made for polishing silver. Starboy's working on a necklace with a large turquoise centerpiece. He is surrounded by vibrantly colored beads and jewelry hanging on each wall. Starboy is the owner of the Bead Gallery. This storefront on Main Street, Sioux Falls, is a rarity in this town. It's one of just a few Native American-owned businesses here.
You see it started to get shiny light? Eventually it gets like a mirror. But anyway, this here is a pendant.
Starboy has rough, calloused hands that reveal the long hours he's put in during nearly 64 years of work. Over the loud hum of an air conditioner, he flashes back to his childhood on the Rosebud Reservation. He grew up in poverty and remembers slicking his hair back with lard, a government-issued commodity. Starboy says on the reservation he couldn't succeed even with a government job.
Like you get up Monday morning and you kind of have a dream of being successful. Then when Friday comes, you're right back where you started from the week before, so you turn to drinking, maybe, you know. And it seemed like all I did was drink because, you know, your dreams are there and it ends on a Friday.
Starboy broke that cycle by moving off the reservation. He's not alone. The Census Bureau found nearly 60% of Native Americans now live in urban areas. But Starboy says leaving the reservation means exchanging one set of problems for another. Starboy quickly learned that because of his race, not everyone would accept him.
Racism is, you always have to live with it. I still live with it today. And racism always stays with you. So no matter where you go, you're ready. You know, you sense it, and if you don't sense it, you relax. And then when you walk out the door, it kind of comes back on you again.
The impact of racism is a common theme among those who move off the reservation. Lorette Poirier moved to Rapid City 13 years ago from the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. Poirier says racism is the biggest hurdle for urban Indians. Poirier is the founder of Sanity, a group dedicated to help Native Americans survive and fight racism. She says there are efforts to promote Native culture to tourists, like this powwow in Rapid City, where the drum signifies the heartbeat of Mother Earth and the people. Poirier says while Native culture is being celebrated, Native people are not really being embraced.
So they're promoting Indian to get tourists to come here, and that's all about money. The flip side of that is how we're treated. When our people are in the hotels or restaurants during those huge events, we're treated badly. So they're saying one thing and doing another.
Poirier says racism and discrimination are contributing to the poverty of Native Americans in Rapid City. She says Native people move off reservations in droves for employment. But Poirier says many Natives are overlooked for jobs or denied decent housing based on their race. Poirier adds that racism is also plaguing schools. She gives an example of a 16-year-old Native American girl enrolled in Rapid City Public Schools. Poirier says a car of boys repeatedly yelled racial slurs at her, even after being disciplined.
In fact, the car stopped and they got out and they said, "You dirty Indian, if you ever report again, we will get you." And so she was scared to death and she quit school. It just gets too painful. You can't keep going. It's horrible.
Many schools across the state are battling high dropout rates of Native American students. Rapid City has seen between 60 to 80% loss of its Native students before graduation. School officials say Native kids face hardships, including poverty and cultural differences. Poirier says racism will never be completely eradicated, but she says to foster understanding, young people need to be educated on Native history and culture.
Okay, I have a worksheet that I want you to fill out.
The Sioux Falls School District is trying to achieve this goal. A slender Native American woman stands in front of a handful of students in a relatively small classroom at Roosevelt High. Marcia Zephyr is describing an accomplished Native American sports athlete to Native and non-Native students.
14 three-pointers in one game, and she plays for the Lady Chiefs.
Zephyr has been teaching this Native American Studies elective course since it started in 2002. She's found many Native students who have lived in urban areas like Sioux Falls their entire lives don't know much about their culture. It's discouraging, she says, because of the link between self-identity and confidence.
Self-identity is self-esteem. We can help students with their self-esteem and identify who they are and where they came from. They're just going to be more successful in life.
Teaching and embracing Native culture is meant to counter dropouts. Zephyr's and the school district's concern is not having a high school diploma leads to a dead end. A challenge Wayne Starboy can understand. Starboy is the Native American business owner in Sioux Falls. He himself dropped out in the 10th grade. Starboy says the need to make money and the poor education at a reservation boarding school drove him to quit. He sits back at the register, watching over his store, as a white woman picks through the beads. Starboy says many of his customers are non-Native. He says it was much the same with an auto repair and convenience store he owned on the reservation years ago. Starboy says it goes back to his traditional Lakota upbringing, which is based not on selling, but sharing.
The Native American tradition, like I told you, I was raised with my grandparents. They teach you to give. You share, you learn. So whenever your next door neighbor has something, we all share it. And if they see somebody else getting ahead of you, they're going to bring it back down to their level.
Starboy was taught money doesn't equal power. How powerful you are is tied to how much you give. Even with this clash between making money and his tradition, he says retaining his cultural heritage is not difficult. He explains that's because Lakota spirituality is practiced every minute of every day, not just at certain events. Interestingly, Starboy says leaving the desperate conditions on the reservation is how he found himself and his identity.
The reservation makes you a little more, you look down on yourself. We're off the reservation, you know who you are, and you also know what's going on back home. So I would suggest to people on the reservation to live off the rest for a little while and then move back. Then you'll know how to survive.
Starboy says he can still be proud to be Native American and play by the rules off the reservation. He hopes that more Native youth might begin to learn who they are and be proud. But he says the guaranteed survival of his culture and his business will require an increased understanding of Native American history and culture.
Living in a world apart from one's own culture requires a high degree of self-sufficiency. Rosalie Little Thunder now has our Lakota word that embodies this ability.
Igluha. Igluha, igluha, igluha means to be self-sufficient. When people say Taya igluha, that means that they're providing for themselves in not being dependent, too dependent on outside of themselves. And so it's an honor, you know, that when you talk about people that way, they're being responsible for themselves. They don't have that sense of entitlement from other people. You know, somebody owes me something. It's they work hard and they take care of themselves.
Native American people are brilliant at the value of igluha. Despite living in poverty, many show a high degree of strength and adaptability in the harshest of situations. But the myth persists that Native people receive monthly checks from the government. Professor Jace DeCorey says this is completely untrue.
It's really funny how people come up with those. Maybe they met one person, you know, that got a check. And maybe it was a land sale check or a lease check or a tax return. But if I were to sit around waiting for the government to give me a check, I probably will die before I get that check.
Economically, South Dakota has some of the poorest areas in the United States. But in terms of cultural resources, arguably, this state is one of the richest in the nation. The tribes of the Dakotas are all alive and strong. Their ancient language and culture remain vibrant. But many of the keepers of the culture are passing on. John around him is one of them. Around him carried within him a vast amount of history, cultural wisdom, and language. His funeral brought out hundreds who paid their respects. His loss also highlighted concerns that very few young people speak the Lakota language. The culture runs the risk of becoming extinct. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Charles Michael Ray spent some time on Pine Ridge, where he spoke with elders and young people about the effort to preserve what it is to be Lakota.
In the early 1980s, two men stepped into a studio in the Senta Gleska College and recorded a group of sacred songs.
Lakota ceremonial songs, performed by John Around Him, translated by Albert Whitehat Sr.
On the surface, the act of recording some sacred songs might not seem like any big deal. But in fact, these recordings mark an important point in history. This tape was made after a near 100-year ban on Lakota spiritual practices. In 1880, Congress outlawed all Native American religious ceremonies, and that ban remained in effect until 1978. Shortly after the ban was lifted, and at the request of a few spiritual leaders, John Around Him shared these songs. While this music is preserved on tape, many of the elders, like John Around Him, are being lost. After a battle with cancer, Around Him passed away. He was a highly cherished elder, and his wake and funeral lasted more than 3 days. Hundreds upon hundreds showed up to pay their respects. On the third day of the funeral, plates are piled high with fry bread, stew, fried chicken, salads, and cake. A traditional feeding and giveaway hosted by the family has packed a Little Wound school in Kyle full of people. Robert Tucro is one of those in the school cafeteria. Tucro grew up with Around Him. He says so many people turned out to honor his old friend because Around Him embodied much of what it means to be a Lakota. In that, Around Him spent many years sacrificing himself for the people.
In a Lakota community, you give yourself. You're always present. You're there helping when the need is there. So that's basically what our relative had.
Teaching the Lakota language is one of the ways in which Around Him helped his community, and the Cha Charging Crow was one of his students.
He was my hero, you know, my idol, you know, and he was what. When I had trouble with the song, he would tell me what that meaning was. As a singer, you need to know what you're singing about. So he taught me a lot, and with the language and the culture, the way of life.
Around Him used traditional songs to teach the Lakota language to school kids in Kyle. It's the same thing that Wayne Broken Nose is trying to do for kids in Wounded Knee. This drum group named White River Crossing is made up almost entirely of Wounded Knee school kids. Language instructor Wayne Broken Nose says Lakota songs are great teaching tools.
Yeah, it helps them a whole lot, especially when it comes to the language. And when they hear the elders talking, they understand what they're saying.
Broken Nose says it's the elders who can instill cultural pride and who most often teach the language. The Cha Charging Crow credits John Around Him as one person who pointed him in a good direction.
I was lost there for a while, and I didn't know what to do or where to go. And one day, you know, one of my relatives showed me Uncle John, you know. That's where I went, and he helped me out, guided me, you know, showed me the sweat. So different ceremonies. I learned a lot from him.
Educators on Pine Ridge note that the youth can learn a great deal from the songs, but they say even more needs to be done to save this language from extinction. Richard Broken Nose works at the school in Oglala. Broken Nose says the No Child Left Behind Act doesn't allow for teaching of the Lakota language the way it should. He says more Lakota needs to be taught in schools.
They have language and culture, but it's not enough. They only give them 10 minutes or 15 minutes to teach them, and they can't learn like that. It has to be at least 4 hours of Lakota language and 4 hours or 5 hours, whatever, it's a second education.
Turning Lakota into more of a primary language on Pine Ridge is one goal of the Language Conservancy and the Lakota Circle Village. Both efforts are working to create a new language immersion school for children on Pine Ridge. Leonard Littlefinger is a Lakota teacher in support of the effort, but Littlefinger says this project is about more than just the preservation of Lakota. He says safeguarding this culture and language protects part of what makes us all human.
So it's valuable. It in fact is a national treasure in my mind. About time, I think we need to stop and realize these things and see the value of what mankind has to offer to itself.
Littlefinger says Lakota is one of about 12 native languages left in the United States that has a chance for survival. But he says time is critical. And Rosalie Littlethunder agrees. Littlethunder teaches Lakota at Black Hills State. She estimates that the language has about 20 years before it's too far gone to save. Littlethunder says it's a struggle to keep Lakota culture alive because it is so different from mainstream society. She says Lakota values are based on self-sacrifice for the community, while mainstream culture is more focused on promotion of the individual.
Lakota culture is definitely in conflict with the capitalistic culture, and I'm not so sure that there is a way to find middle ground. You have to make severe sacrifices. And people either become capitalistic, or if they choose to or can't leave behind being Lakota, then they're at the lower stratus of society, the homeless and very poor. And if they're going to be Lakota and be compassionate and have collective responsibility, then that is the only place they can do that.
Little Thunder says no one chooses to live in poverty, but she says Lakota people are forced to live biculturally. They must survive in the white world while upholding Lakota ways.
And it reads, Andrea, my deepest condolences. And
back in the Little Wound School, the family is getting ready for the traditional giveaway that is part of the funeral ceremony for John Around Him. The drum group is about to start another song as a teenage boy, Justin Dorian, slips out the back door of the school's gym and into the cool autumn air. It's early evening, and a sliver of a moon is about to set in the west. Dorian says he wants to share a song that his grandpa John taught him before he passed on. John Around Him had a dream that all Lakota youth would be able to freely learn and speak their language. It's people like this young man who will take up the struggle to keep this language and culture alive for future generations.
Producer of Tribes of Dakota is Charles Michael Ray, with assistance from Francis Lim, Gary Ellenbolt, Julia Manzansky, Chuck Beck, and Johanna Saylor. I'm Charlie Aberesk. This has been a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.